Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay, so I'm doing an intro, all right? I'm doing this.
Go for it.
Hi everyone. With Halloween coming up, Dr. Shahom Das and I wanted to treat you with some extra episodes. We're doing some true crime stuff. We're looking into some pretty out there criminals from Anders Breivik and some Swedish twins. You'll learn about them later, to Peter Brian the Broadmoor Cannibal. This is the first episode of the three. They'll each be, what will they be? Half an hour each, Dr. Shahom?
Yeah, I think so. I suppose it depends how spicy the conversation gets, but half an hour's the target, I think.
Yeah, this is going to be great. What do you hope to get from these episodes?
I just think that the cases that you and I have chosen have all got a psychiatric element. And because that's what I do for a living, assess people who've got mental illnesses and talk about their individual symptoms, I just quite like to talk about that and educate the public maybe a little bit, not just about how the symptoms work and cause violence, but also about how it's all dealt with and the rehabilitation behind it all.
That's right. We should go into your background a bit and who you are and who I am, because we're going to put this out on my audio podcast stream and on your YouTube channel. So do you want to tell people from my stream about a little bit about your YouTube channel and your background?
Sure, I'd love to. So I'm a consultant forensic psychiatrist. So my job basically entails assessing people who've committed a very serious crime. Usually it's an assault. Sometimes it can be up to murder, attempted murder, sometimes sexual assault, who either have or are suspected of having a mental illness. Usually something like schizophrenia, which is quite relevant to some of our cases today, bipolar affective disorder, sometimes personality disorders. So that's what I do professionally. And then my YouTube channel basically draws on that experience. So I make videos about individual high-profile true crime cases, and I break down my own psychoanalysis. Well, sometimes I just talk about mental health issues, like individual diagnoses, personality disorder, for example. And I kind of break it down and explain it myself. So yeah, something for everybody on my channel.
And that is called A Psych for Sore Minds, as in a sight for sore eyes. But that's the play on words. So everyone
can
remember
two puns in one phrase.
Yeah, I mean, how many words do you have to make into a pun before it's no longer recognisable? I suppose two is the maximum. If it was three words that I changed.
Two is optimum, I believe.
Yeah, two is optimum. Psych for Sore Minds. And that's on YouTube. Do follow him, because aside from wanting to enlighten everybody about these fascinating, you know, recesses of the mind, a big part of why we're doing this is also to share one another's channels with our own, with one another's fans. So do check out Psych for Sore Minds on YouTube. And if you're watching this, I don't know how Dr. Shahom... Do I have to keep calling you Dr. Shahom or just Shahom?
Just Shahom. It's fine.
Yeah. Or Dr. Das. Okay, yeah, Shahom's... YouTube channel. If you're watching this on there, I don't know how he's going to edit it together, but mine is On the Edge with Andrew Gold on YouTube or audio podcast app or wherever, where I talk to lots of different strange people. I'm a journalist with a background in the BBC, and that, you know, I interviewed strange and controversial people, a bit like Louis Theroux, but not as famous or handsome or successful. So yes.
Do you want to just mention for my viewers maybe a couple of the people you've interviewed, just to whet their appetite?
Oh yeah. Okay, well, so there, yeah, psychopaths have been on the show, and murderers. I mean, I'm just thinking about Shahom's sort of viewership. So in that sort of background, yeah, in that sort of theme, they people who have killed people who have, you know, been in prison or true crime stuff. But there's also, yeah, some surprising ones that you never might expect. I like to surprise people. So one week you might have a woman who remembers every moment of her life back to the womb. And another time you might have, I don't know, even a thought leader, political or whatever, someone controversial, a guy who taught his dog to do a Nazi salute. He was pretty controversial. So pretty much everything weird and strange and different you can imagine, that's what you get on The Edge with Andrew Gold. So yeah, please do come and subscribe. So today, this first one, we're going to start with probably the most famous well, but I think the most famous true crime person in the last whatever, which is Anders Breivik, because what he did was just so extraordinarily horrible. And I'm just going to, you know, do a little intro here that I've written up, which is that we'll be talking about Anders Behring Breivik, who's changed his name, I didn't realize, to Fjodolf Hansen. He's now 42 years old. He's in prison serving time for far-right domestic terrorism. Most of you will know him or know of him and remember the 2011 Norway attacks when he killed 8 people in a bomb in a cargo van in Oslo, as well as 69 teenagers at a summer camp, the most fatalities by a single gunman ever. On the day of the attacks, he emailed a compendium of texts on European independence out into the world, and he called for the deportation of all Muslims from the continent. Once arrested, a psychiatric team diagnosed Breivik with paranoid schizophrenia, but after this initial finding was criticized, a second evaluation concluded that he was not psychotic during the attacks, but did have narcissistic personality disorder and antisocial personality disorder. Convicted of mass murder, causing a fatal explosion and terrorism, but those are three different things, yes, mass murder, causing a fatal explosion and terrorism, he was found sane and guilty of murdering 77 people. What do you think was going on there? I think because that's quite an interesting one, that he was initially told, you know, that he had some sort of insanity, and then that was criticized and that was changed. So what really went on there?
That's a very interesting point. It's also quite controversial because it doesn't make sense that a diagnosis changes with political pressure. So either one of two things has happened. Either they got it wrong the first time, which I think is probably more likely, or they got it right, but actually literally changed their reports or changed their opinions, which regardless of what you think of Breivik, the actual man, it doesn't make the system, you know, objective or fair if that's what happened. So would it be helpful to maybe go through those diagnoses and explain them and the differences?
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's start with paranoid schizophrenia. I'm sure all of your viewers would have heard the phrase. So schizophrenia is a tendency to have periods of psychosis. And psychosis is stepping outside of reality. Usually that's in the form of one of two symptoms. So either hallucinations, most commonly hearing voices, or delusions, which are a sort of fixed, unshakable, untrue beliefs that don't come from an understandable source. The reason I added that caveat in the end is that, for example, religious extremism within a community does come from an understandable source. But Breivik's extremism, his far-right views, it wasn't sort of cultivated or cultured from his upbringing and his background. So what it boils down to was he out of touch of reality? Like, did he know what he was doing at the time? And I think he probably did, because to me, this does scream of narcissism. Everything about him screams of narcissism. So he believed that Europe needed to be saved from Islam, from terrorism, from radical Islam, I should say. And he believed that it was justified to be solved with violence. But, and this is the crux of the matter, what he did didn't really make sense. He didn't attack Muslims, or he didn't attack... I think he vaguely attacked people that supported some of the socialist ideas, but there was no sensible reason for him to attack the people that he attacked. I think he just did it all for attention. And there were other odd things about him. So for example, when he went to court, he wore a uniform, and he wore medals on his uniform that weren't his. He didn't earn these medals. It was because he, in his own mind, saw himself as being this very special, very talented, very blessed person. Yeah. He even called himself commander. So he named himself, he referred to himself as the commander of a resistance movement. So all of this screams to me, not somebody who's out of touch of reality, but rather somebody who just loves himself. Like, it's all about his ego. It's all about attention.
And inflated sense of self-worth.
Absolutely. Yeah. So grandiosity, which is exactly what you just said. Even the fact that he picked this particular cause at that time that was really popular, and there's a lot of political debate going on. So I think it's all about attention rather than truly about, you know, ending what he believed was terrorism in Europe.
So why the Muslim stuff? And yeah, that you raise a really fascinating point, and one that I suppose maybe we thought about at the time, and then that's, I sort of forgot about that, because it's just, I know what he did on that island with all those kids, and it's just, he could quite simply have gone to a mosque and killed loads of people there. Do you think he thought he'd get more attention with the island, because it's just such a strange and random thing to do.
Yeah, I think so. I think to him it felt like the least amount of effort with the highest degree of potential success to get the maximum amount of attention. Yeah.
Man, it's really horrific. Okay, so that's schizophrenia, was it, right? And so I just, yeah, on schizophrenia, it's such a hard one, isn't it? Because so at what point do you say, okay, somebody is just mad? Because these are mad ideas. These are, okay, an inflated sense of self-worth or grandiosity, but this is madness what he did. So how can we say, okay, this isn't schizophrenia? Because it just is consistent?
So the first thing I should say is that the vast majority of people that have schizophrenia are not violent, and I don't want to sort of add to the stigma that's attached between mental illness and offending. It's just that I happen to work in that area in forensic psychiatry, so the patients that I see are exactly that. They're at that crossroads. But to answer your question, it's not actually really about the diagnosis. It's about whether they were criminally culpable at the time. So with something like schizophrenia, some people can have very intense short-term symptoms, and some people can have long-term chronic paranoid ideas that have been there for years. Mm-hmm. So it's not even about the actual idea. It's about what they were thinking at the time. So to boil it down to its very basics, if Breivik believed that if he knew what he was doing was wrong, when I'm talking about the insanity defense here, or the legal term for insanity, if he knew what he was doing was wrong, then by definition, he's not legally insane. So he might feel really justified, and he might feel that he's making a point, that he's getting an attention. He might even believe that certain segments of society would applaud him, but he still knew he was breaking the law. Mm-hmm. Versus, for example, somebody with schizophrenia. So I've seen other cases of one that pops into my mind of a mother kind of killing her child. Another case of a young girl who killed her little nephew. It's different because at the time they believed they had to do that. So the mother killing her child believed that the child was possessed by, was hearing the voice of Satan and had to kill the child to stop them going to hell. For the 18-year-old girl that I assessed, she believed that this boy was covered in demons and that she had to get rid of these demons. So do you see the difference? They actually yeah. thought what they were doing was legally and morally, well, legally right, because they thought they had no other options. So it all boils down to that. Did they know what they were doing? And if so, did they know that it was legally acceptable or not?
Yeah. That situation you just described with the mother is touched on. Maybe that's a bit of a spoiler, actually. I was going to spoil something, a new film that's on Netflix, but I won't say which one it is, but it has Jake Gyllenhaal in it. Maybe that's ruined it, but it doesn't matter. Maybe it does. I don't know. Write in angrily if you've ruined a Jake Gyllenhaal movie, if that's how you pronounce his name. So what did Breivik actually do? He went to this summer camp, right? Who were these summer camp people? Was it a Christian one?
I can't actually remember the name of the society off the top of my head, but
yeah.
Excuse me. But I think it was affiliated with a political party, yeah, who he saw as very liberal.
Oh, man. How terrifying. So he just went around and he had a big gun and was just shooting everyone. The kids were on the phone to their parents, weren't they? And they were getting, hiding in places. Really horrific. When you deal with things like this, obviously this is a particular standout case that's different to anything else, I suppose, but do you find yourself getting emotionally involved, or has it gotten to the point where you've worked with people for so long that it's just another day's work?
I think it's more the latter. It would be exceptional to see somebody that's carried out that many killings. I think in terms of patients that I've personally assessed, the most I've ever seen is a man who killed three of his ex-partners. So, you know, 77 victims is huge compared to that. So generally speaking, I think I'm a bit emotionally detached. I think you have to be. And when you see these cases over and over again, I might see two or three in a typical week. And I've been doing that for, you know, 10 years. Then you become inured. But to be honest with you, I think I've always had a bit of a detached sense and a bit of just in my personality. Maybe I'm a bit psychopathic. I've always been a little bit detached from the cases anyway.
Yeah, we touched on that on your episode on my podcast a few weeks ago, actually, didn't we? That slightly psychopathic nature that maybe some doctors have to have. I suppose 77 people is no different to one in terms of the empathy of, you know, in terms of the squeamishness, for example, if I had to be a doctor and go in for one day, if I saw one person who was just seeing a dead, but I don't think I've ever seen a dead person, so I don't know how much difference it would make, 77 or one. I think either way it would just absolutely break me, because it would be such a strange thing, but it's not something I'm used to being around, I guess.
I suppose The problem is, if you do get too emotional, then it might affect the objectivity of what you're trying to assess. So to give you a specific, to think about this case specifically, I can't say for a fact this is what happened, because I didn't see the individual reports. But if somebody gets too emotionally invested, a psychiatrist, then they might lean towards saying that Breivik didn't have a mental illness when he actually did, or that he wasn't criminally that he was criminally responsible when he actually wasn't. And I suppose the problem with that is, firstly, why bother having the assessment in the first place? If the judge wants to only punish and not rehabilitate, then that's absolutely fine. That's the prerogative of the court. I have no problem with that. But don't have a forensic psychiatry assessment and then, you know, either ignore it or have one that's false, because then it just kind of makes a mockery of the whole system. Yeah, so you have to be objective, I think, to a degree.
And yet the opposite happened in this case, because he was said to be insane initially and then not. So why do you think that happened?
I suppose it all boils down to the quality of the evidence. If the original reports, and I believe it was multiple reports, were watertight, and if they were really sure about the diagnosis, unfortunately, this information is not out in the public domain, so I don't think we'll ever know for sure. But if they were really clear that these are the signs of schizophrenia, because there are other things that I've not talked about. So, for example, schizophrenia is associated with a cognitive blunting, which means that the average person, their speed thought processes decrease over time, which doesn't happen in narcissistic PD. So that's another factor. But so if they had all the different factors for schizophrenia and had a really strong argument that he was diagnosed with schizophrenia, and then the judges said, no, we're not really happy with that, then I can only assume that there was political pressure, that people wanted him to suffer and be punished as opposed to being rehabilitated, and that that pressure forced the psychiatrist to change their minds, if that's what happened. However, if the report was a bit wishy-washy and they didn't really have a lot of evidence, and they kind of, you know, were saying, we're not sure, but on balance it's schizophrenia, then I think it's a lot more reasonable for that opinion to be changed.
Okay. Yeah, and to be honest, I mean, if you're locked up in a psychiatric ward for the rest of your life, that's suffering still, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we would like to think of it as a place of rehabilitation, but yeah, your freedom's certainly gone. Yeah, and I think for the patients themselves, they probably feel in many ways it's like prison. I suppose the main difference is that the ethos is slightly different. In prison, it's all about punishment. You might have access to some psychiatric help. You might have medication prescribed for you, for example, whereas in psychiatric units, the whole point is to rehabilitate. So the entire time you're trying to engage the patients with different forms of therapy, you're trying to kind of medicate them to the best of your ability.
And was Breivik, in your mind, a psychopath?
So I think he certainly had some of the traits of psychopathy. I mean, he goes to that question that he massively lacked any kind of empathy. He didn't care about the law, didn't care about the rights of others. But I don't think he was a classic psychopath, because he had all those bits and all the narcissistic bits, but he wasn't particularly manipulative or deceitful. So a classic psychopath is very charming and they get people on their side, whereas Breivik never had that. So if he was a psychopath, I'm not talking about the kind of fringe right-wing people that just loved him because, you know, because he was so violent and because he was, you know, anti-radical Islam. I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about the average normal people, the press. They didn't go on his, they weren't on his side. They didn't try and give it, they didn't try and sort of understand him, and they weren't bought in by his charms. For example, compared to Ted Bundy would be a great example of somebody who, even though he was on trial, he still charmed the reporters to a degree, the police even to a degree. They liked him. They connected with him. They sort of gave him a little bit of leeway. None of that happened to Breivik. So I don't think he's a classic psychopath.
Helps if you're handsome, though, like Ted Bundy.
Yeah, does help.
Yeah. And as Breivik's got, he's horror, is that weasel face.
If you're going to be a psychopath, then, you know, have the look.
Yeah, well, that's like, you know, American Psycho. And there's that series You. And there's that other one, Dexter. Which I haven't seen those ones, but I know that they're very handsome men. So I think that must help get the viewer on board with the charms of the psychopath.
I think a psychopath uses whatever's at their disposal, male or female, if it's its looks, if it's sexuality. They use anything just to manipulate others, really.
The psychopath, one of the psychopaths I've had on my podcast was Emmy Thomas, and she talks a lot about how good looking she is, and that people are taken in by her looks, and she hides her face on the webcam, so she puts sellotape, but I have seen her on some other videos where she didn't put the sellotape over the webcam, and I think people in general disagreed with her claim that she was really, really good looking, but she obviously felt that way because she had a, you know, inflated sense of self-worth, so
yeah.
So what do we know about Breivik's background or childhood that might have contributed to his personality?
So from the bits and pieces that I know, he had a very bizarre childhood. So his father wasn't really around for most of it. But despite that, his father fought for custody for Breivik when he was little. And then he just suddenly disappeared and suddenly disowned him. So on the one hand, you got this father who kind of pretends to care and then disappears out of the blue. And then his mother used to pamper him until he basically carried out his atrocities. So to me, this really must have messed with his sense of who he is, his identity. So when you form your boundaries, it's all about your feedback from your parents. So a good parent will show you emotion, show you warmth, but also tell you off when you're doing something wrong. That's just what everybody expects. You need this kind of feedback. So I think what happened with Breivik is that he struggled to have this feedback. On the one hand, he had a mum who actually doted on him, and on the other hand, he had a father who was indifferent to him. So I think he probably had really messed up, kind of polarized self-images. So on part of him felt worthless and shameless, I think, whereas another big part of him felt grandiose. So I think he pushed everything. He put all his emotional eggs in the basket of feeling grandiose, and he had this massive inferiority complex of actually feeling worthless and shameful. Yeah. And also the other thing that I think it's not really about his childhood, but that kind of ties into it all, was his actual ideology was really mixed up. So obviously his main ethos was this anti-radical Islam, anti-terrorism, but he also identified, according to his sort of rambling writings, with the Freemasons, with Hindu nationalism. So that just, to me, it shows somebody who's just very confused. You know, he doesn't have one set of beliefs. He has lots and lots of different sets of beliefs. And yeah, just very, very messed up psychologically.
Yeah. That sort of smothering mother is a common theme. Again, I'm thinking of the movies because that's all I know. I don't have real life experience. But of course, the original, you know, Psycho was about a mother, a smothering mother. And then there's Pink Floyd's The Wall is all about that as well. And I wonder if that's a strange trope, isn't it? It's a strange, funny thing. And it sort of seems to screw up, at least in movies, it screws up boys. Did he feel maybe emasculated, do you think? Like his father didn't want, you know, the boys don't want anything to do with you, but mummy's here. Do you think that's part of it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think he felt rejected by his father and he internalized that. And even before he carried out the atrocities, we know that he was also rejected by a few internet groups. So I believe he tried to join a gaming group and they weren't interested. And then he even tried to push some of his political ideas into smaller internet fringe groups, and they also kind of dismissed him. So I think it's all connected, everything from this inferiority complex to his dad rejecting him, to his mother being overly sympathetic, to building up his ego, to then being rejected. I think it's all kind of connected.
Wow. Did he ever do anything before? Because it's quite a leap to go from nothing to blowing up a van and then killing 70 people.
Yeah, that's a good question. As to my knowledge, he certainly didn't commit any serious violence. But you're right, that is a big leap. And that's another reason why I don't think he's a classic psychopath, because psychopaths generally offend repeatedly over a very long period of time. And it might escalate. Sometimes they get caught, sometimes they don't. But their whole outlook is about manipulating people right from a young age. And that doesn't seem to be the picture with Breivik.
Yeah, they often start with like animals and things like that, and they move on to, you know, people. Just the thought of, and it's something to remember when we talk about these things. There are so many true crime podcasts and stuff that do this, you know, every week, and we obviously I often wonder, why do people listen to them? Why are we so interested And I guess we're titillated, and I wonder if it's a sense of there, but for the grace of God, go I. On both sides, you know, could I be a murderer? You know, we watch enough movies, or could I be murdered? And both are very scary thoughts to us. What I think it's important for us to remember, I suppose, is that people really lost their lives, didn't they? And we talk about, and to imagine the scenes. It's just extraordinary. I can't even begin to picture it, like him wandering around this island and just shooting people. I can't get my head to that place. I don't know. I mean, do you think we've all got that in us, or do you have to be, there's something different in the brain?
I think both, actually. I think that when I look at, somebody once told me this analogy, and it's like a lock, like a bicycle lock. Everybody's got the potential to commit horrific kind of violence, including murder, but the lock has to click in a certain combination for everybody. And there might be several different factors, and it might be things that we've talked about. So it might be harsh parenting or oversympathetic parenting. It might be witnessing domestic violence, could be poverty, could be being bullied, could be being provoked, could be drugs and alcohol. So there's so many different factors. So I think all of us potentially, if we had those factors placed on us, could eventually have all the parts of the lock clicked so that we could do that. Yeah. But yeah, there's so many different things that it only happens to a very, very small proportion. And I think we have to remember that. And it's easy to sensationalize these things, and these cases are fascinating. I'm interested, as are you, but they are exceptionally rare as well. So the vast majority of people that go through these experiences won't have all of those factors clicking in at the right way at the right time.
I always think about that, how rare it is. And I that amazes me, because there are just so many people. We can't even imagine how many people there are just in the UK, for example. It's a stupid number. What was it, 70 million? It's a ridiculous number. Yeah. You can't even get your head around that. So you just think, when I'm driving on the motorway, I'm always thinking, like, how is it possible? Why are there not people who are just nuts and are just going, I'm just going to smash into him for fun? It just doesn't happen. I think there must be more nuts people. Why aren't there more people bashing into me? So that's quite a miracle. How close are you for your lock clicking? Could your lock ever click and turn you murderous?
No, I don't think so. I think I'm generally quite in control of my emotions. I get frustrated, as do all people, but I've never had murderous thoughts. No, so I've got, come even close to that. No. Yeah, what about you?
Very, very psychopathic answer that. No, I couldn't hurt a fly. But maybe I am one of those guys in a movie or whatever. Again, I'm thinking of movies and tropes and stuff, who's just always extra kind, then just flips one day because he's let people take advantage of him his whole life. But no, I think growing up tall was a big thing of that. What an early memory I had when I was 13, because when I was 13, I was 6'3". Right, which is like 192 for people with metric system, and luckily I didn't grow at all after that. I just stayed exactly that height and sort of filled out a bit. I was a beanpole. It was ridiculous, but yeah, grew very, very early. And I always remember going to, like, my first dance. I went to, like, this dance somewhere, and I remember opening the door, and these two girls looked up, and they sort of mock screamed, like, ah, at me. And obviously it just stuck with me, that story. And I think when you're a lot of tall people that age as well feel the same way. So we hang out and talk to each other, us the tall people, and you then, the last thing you want is to ever feel or be intimidating to anyone else. You want to, so it is interesting to see how these sort of childhood things probably affect you in different ways. So my movements became extra, soft, and to show I was extra calm. Any sports I played, I didn't want to be in, like, you know, football, I didn't want to be an attacker or a defender. I'd be like the winger. I want to be the guy who's like running and doing all the little, instead of the hard guy. So I think, yeah, these things affect us in different ways. And then I knew loads of short guys who were very aggressive, and I can understand how that must happen as well. But, you know, anyway, back to Breivik and less about me and my height and stuff. Would the case have been dealt with legally differently in the UK?
I think the biggest difference would be his imprisonment. So my understanding is that in the Norwegian system, the maximum that anyone can have in prison for whatever crime is 21 years, which is what he was sentenced to. Obviously, they are not used to dealing with this magnitude of crime because it's exceptionally rare. Whereas in the UK, he probably, almost certainly would have been given a whole life tariff. So he would have been there for the rest of his life. He would have died in prison. Yeah.
Oh man, is there a chance of him really actually getting out and you know doing whatever he might do again?
I think as far as I'm aware, legally they have to release him after his time's up. There's no actual legal recourse. I think I don't know enough about the Norwegian system, but I assume that there'll be a very, very high level of support and observation. So he'd probably be discharged into like a hostel where he would have like workers. Presume he told me he's already changed his name. I think his identity will be hidden. So yeah, but he will. My understanding is there's no legal recourse to stop him doing what he wants to do. So he can leave the hostel whenever he wants, and he can walk around, and he will be a free man. Yeah,
man, he can't hide his identity though, because he's probably the most famous person in Norway.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, in terms of, I mean, we know what he looks like. He'd have to change his looks and stuff, and then Norway. Well, I guess it is big, but it's not in terms of population though. But he'll just kill people. Oh, I don't know. Do you think would he kill again?
It's really hard to say without assessing him in person. And I suppose there's two ways of thinking about it. One way of thinking about it is that he is so narcissistic that, and it, because he's been rejected by the entire system. When I say that, I mean, he didn't become this superstar, sort of infamous, celebrated terrorist. Instead, he got thrown into jail and I imagine treated quite harshly in jail. So you could, one argument is that his narcissistic shell has been broken and he just wants to attack back, in which case, yeah, he absolutely has potential to kill again. And I suppose the other potential is that over time, despite this huge narcissism, he will have learnt that he didn't get what he wanted. So it could go either way. There's two very strong psychological reactions.
If I were him, I'd be sitting there every day, like plotting my revenge on society, because he must feel like everyone's against him and all this stuff. I just feel like he's got to have something plot. I mean, you wouldn't want him moving into a house near you, would you? I mean, can somebody who's committed this extreme level of violence ever be rehabilitated or released in your mind?
I think that all depends on the degree of their personality and their symptoms and their degree of criminal culpability. So if we have another theoretical set of circumstances where Breivik definitely did have paranoid schizophrenia and he had delusions and he was acting directly on those delusions. So hypothetically, if he believed that all the people on those in the island were, evil assassins and they were going to kill everybody else in the world, for example, and he believed that he had to do that to save humankind. So that definitely didn't happen, just to be clear, but I'm saying hypothetically, if that did. And if that was caused by schizophrenia, then he could be treated to the degree that those symptoms completely assuage. So his risk could be massively minimized. That's not to take away or detract from the horrific nature of his crime or the sadness and tragedy for all the victims. But in terms of thinking about it purely academically from a risk assessment point of view, you can make him safe. So as long as he took like a regular antipsychotic, say in an injectable form that he turned up for every couple of weeks, and as long as he was seen in the community on a regular basis to somebody to assess his mental state to make sure he's not relapsing, then in theory, he could be released. Having said all that, the fact that he's got 77 victims is so high profile and so high risk, and it would be such an embarrassment to the system if he did go out and kill again, that I think that most people who'd be in charge of him, so the consultant forensic psychiatrist, if in those circumstances, if he had paranoid schizophrenia, would probably think it's just too big a risk. So he probably would be never discharged from hospital, but maybe he'd go to like a low secure unit, so he'd have a lot of the freedoms and maybe have, for example, escorted leave with nurses as opposed to unescorted leave. So it kind of depends on how much of a risk the consultant wants to take.
It's such a tough one because I think so many of us, especially liberal-minded people among us, we like to think of, oh, hey, we rehabilitate people. We don't lock them up for life. But when you've killed 77 people, if that person were to go out and kill someone else, and you have to think about those victims, you've got to think, if you're a liberal-minded person, you've got to think about the victims as well, the potential victims in the future. You've got to think about the families of the first victims as well. And as you were saying before, do you want revenge or do you want to rehabilitate? There's so many things to think about. I'm happy you used the word assuage because I've spent a whole lifetime wondering how to pronounce that because I always thought it might be assuage. and assuage, that's a good one. But yeah, I think that was a good summary of that. Do you think that was good on Anders Breivik?
Yeah, absolutely. Good episode.
We got our got a half an hour done on that. I hope that people found that fascinating and interesting. It's obviously quite a short one, but obviously if you want to know more about the mind, go to A Psych for Sore Minds, where you'll get all these lovely videos about the mind and true crime stuff. And otherwise, if you're on that channel now, then come to mine, On the Edge with Andrew Gold, and you'll just get to hear me rambling about nonsense as I tend to do. But join us on the next one, which is going to be about Swedish twins, Sabina and Ursula Eriksson. What, should people join us on that one, Sean?
Yeah, I think this is not quite as gruesome, at least in terms of the victims, as Anders Breivik, but in terms of just the psychiatry behind it, extremely unusual. One of the rarest presentations I think that's ever happened in the world.
Oh, fantastic. I'm looking forward to that one. But the way it worked was Shahom presented me with a list of really, really interesting cases, and then I chose three of them for our big Halloween specials. Thank you for joining us on this one. Do get in touch with both of us. We love hearing from you guys. And join us on the next one.
Thank you for having me on, Andrew. Absolute pleasure.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.